All right, today's episode, we interviewed Bill Snow, an investment banker. And man, what a wealth of knowledge. Not only is he an investment banker, he's also the author of M&A for Dummies, and he's been around the block. And so we talked a lot about what it takes to search, how to basically negotiate a deal, how to finance a deal, and how to work with investment bankers and what that interaction looks like. So Casey, what were some of your takeaways?
Well, I think one of the biggest questions that almost anybody has is networking capital conversation.
Which is one that we've experienced the hard way, right?
Oh my God. And Bill went into something that is typically very complex and explains it very, very well.
Yeah. And so if you're buying a business, it's important to understand what networking capital is and why that's part of the business. It needs to stay part of the business. So that was definitely one big one. I think another one is really understanding how to market yourself, right? And how to build rapport with others, whether you're looking to talk directly with a seller, a broker, or somebody else. And, you know, ultimately, it's about how to be memorable.
Yeah. And then just having that empathy about the search, because, you know, you've talked so many times about, I've searched, I can't find a business, or I haven't found a business. And he really comes home to say, I've been doing this for 40 years. Search is the hard part, right? Yeah. And it's all hard, but he was just, a lot of empathy there.
Yeah. But ultimately, it was kind of interesting to see that the part that he enjoys the most is negotiating, right? And we really did dive in on what negotiating looks like, right? It's not about creating a win-lose situation. It's ultimately about how do you create win-win situations where both sides are getting what they want? How do you go about them and ultimately walk out on the back end with an actual transaction, not a place where everybody kind of parts ways because everybody's upset that the thing didn't really work out the way they wanted it to.
Yeah, it's poker, right? But not poker for the bluff. It's more poker for the strategy.
Reading the room. Yeah, so definitely lots of golden nuggets in this one. I mean, you know, super, super informative. I think Casey took a whole page of notes. So we'll hop right in. Welcome to the M&A Launchpad podcast with your hosts, Casey and Ferris with Equity Launchpad. On this podcast, you will gain insights on acquiring, investing in, and selling profitable businesses in the lower to middle market. Whether you're a business owner, investor, or aspiring entrepreneur, at Equity Launchpad, we will provide you with the knowledge, guidance, and capital to navigate the world of mergers and acquisitions. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the M&A Launchpad. On today's show, we got Bill Snow. Bill Snow brings over 30 years of extensive experience in the mergers and acquisitions landscape with nearly two decades dedicated to investment banking. His expertise encompasses orchestrating business sales, facilitating capital raises for middle market companies, and providing buy-side services for acquirers targeting middle market entities. As an accomplished author, Bill has penned four published books, notably Mergers and Acquisitions for Dummies. Bill is also a sought-after speaker, sharing his wealth of knowledge and insights with audiences seeking to navigate the complex world of M&A. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Awesome. I'm glad to have you on. So mergers and acquisitions, right? A topic that we love dearly and, you know, would love to kind of share with the audience. You want to maybe hop right in, right? What's the biggest mistake people do in mergers and acquisitions and kind of how they think about it?
Well, they think about it completely wrong. It depends on what their perspective is. A lot of times, a lot of lay people will look at what I do and they think it's open outcry. They think it's the stock market, people yelling, screaming, and doing the hand signals and making trades. That's not what we do in lower middle market private transactions. For a lot of business owners selling their business, I think they tend to think of it as a listing service, like selling a piece of real estate. It's completely different than that. For business owners or executives who want to make acquisitions, they don't realize how difficult making acquisitions is.
Oh, and it's tough.
So it really depends on the perspective, but there's a lot of misconceptions.
Got it. So ultimately just learning how difficult it is, right? It's easier to read a book on it, no pun intended, than it is to actually go out there and do it, right, Bill?
I highly recommend everybody watching this go out and buy 2,000-3,000 copies of Mergers and Acquisitions for the dog.
And don't worry, we'll get a referral fee on that piece. So
yeah, absolutely.
So Bill, where I kind of got my cut into this space was I got into finance and I was a broker for many years, starting out in the real estate side. And then right around 2010, I had a couple of guys approach me and say, hey, we're looking to buy a company. Can you help us find the financing? And I'm like, of course. And so I started helping them find the finance. I helped probably about a dozen people make acquisitions, right? Then I got really accustomed, and these were non-SBA acquisitions. These were using ABL financing, you know, factoring and things like that. Then we started learning more about the SBA. I've helped a ton of people on the real estate side with SBA, buy owner-occupied real estate. The long story short is, as a finance guy, I'm like, man, these guys are able to just, you know, look at what they've done. So I said, I'm going to do it myself, right? And that's how I entered into the space. And so, you know, some of the things you talk about, which are, you know, search, negotiate, and finance, right? And I think you were just telling us earlier that finance, you feel, is the easiest part. But someone like me, I sit there being from finance, I'm like, well, man, it's complicated too. So it's like, wow, So why don't you kind of start off a little bit about your structure and those things? And
Yeah, well, when you look at M&A, first of all, there's buy side or sell side. Are you selling something? You're buying something. That's a misconception too. A lot of people don't realize or don't think about it. It's one of the obvious things. Let's just look at the buy side, which is the most difficult thing. One of the most difficult things I think you can do in business. It is brain damage work. We were talking about that before. Casey, you're very impressive, very intelligent, but I can tell you were far more intelligent before you started buying companies too, because it will knock your brain cells out. Buying companies, I divide that into three main buckets of work, which is search, negotiate, and finance. We'll take this in reverse order real quick, and we can dive into as much detail in any of these as you wish. The finance part is actually the easiest. That's not to say it's easy. It's not to say that there's money on every street corner, but if you've got a company with a balance sheet, if you've got your own money, if you're trying to acquire something that has value, you can usually come up with the financing to do that if you've got the right background and experience. That is quite often the easiest. That's the most straightforward. Negotiation, that's the fun part of this job. That's where you can have an absolute blast trying to be creative and figure it out. And it's not bluffing. It's not trying to take advantage of someone. You have to negotiate for yourself. The other side has to negotiate for themselves. But that's the most fun, trying to figure that out.
And I'll interrupt you actually really quickly. And I think they're heavily related, right? I think one of the things that I love about this space versus commercial real estate is that you can use negotiation to enable the financing, right? You can get really creative, really do unique things to make a deal work, right? And so if seller, like you said, it's not about negotiating where one person's losing. It's about getting both sides what they want. And you have to get creative on the negotiating to get the financing that you need to make the deal work so both sides are happy.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's a great overlap, and I'm obviously greatly simplifying all the steps and the processes involved with this. The last piece is the search piece. That's actually the first. And this is the most difficult part of the M&A process, just simply trying to find a company to buy. It gets the short shrift from whether it's an individual looking to buy a company, from even private equity firms, trying to simply find a company to buy. We can dig into as much detail as you want there. The big mistake that a lot of people make is they call up people like me, an investment banker, show me your menu, show me what you have, like we're a restaurant or a grocery store. And I have to tell them, it doesn't work that way. You, the buyer, are not pushing the cart down the aisle at the grocery store. You're the product up on the shelf. The business owner, the seller of that business, is quite often the one who's going to select who the buyer is. So in that regard, the role of buyer and seller quite often are reversed in M&A. Why? Because number of buyers far exceeds the number of sellers, okay? You have a 45-year-old guy, runs a business, made $3 million last year, loves what he does, his health is good, wife is happy, he's got young kids at home. You could not offer that guy enough money to sell his company, right? And so that's why it is, one of the reasons why it's so hard to simply find companies to buy, because what am I gonna do with my, I don't need any more money, what am I gonna do with myself? I absolutely love what I do. And if you have something that goes to market, I believe that in M&A, it is a microeconomic activity. The macroeconomic, the general economy, yeah, that can have an impact on companies. But as long as a company performs well, it will command a good price. Whether the economy is good or bad, a good company will command a price. A bad company in a good economy is going to struggle to get bids. So it's really hard for the buyers out there to buy companies, because you have a good company for sale, you're only going to sell it once. You're not going to have multiple companies that you can sell. You can't replicate it. So it is really, really hard for people who want to buy companies simply to find the company to buy, let alone negotiate a deal and find the financing for it.
So Bill, I talked to a lot of people, in especially as we build our branded equity launch pad, saying, hey, we have that sponsor back mentality. We want to find good operators and back them. And, the trade between us and them, and we've had a lot of presentations with the guys showing them, look, we're going to take a majority of the equity of the deal for putting it up together. One of the biggest conversations I get from the guys are like, well, hold on. I do all the search. I bring you the deal. You bring the equity and the debt and all that good stuff. And I'm giving up a big chunk of the deal. And I'm like, well, here's the difference about us. We're going to help you search. And you don't understand, like all of a sudden it changes everything. Because these guys have been searching for 1, 2, 3 years, and there's just some people that know how to hunt, right? And bring those deals in and at least get an opportunity. So dig in a little deeper in regards to the search, because I think probably a lot of the people that are here today, they're listening and they're listening to this podcast, the searching part, you're right. It's the one where most people are just, when we talk to them, it's like, man, I've been doing this for 2 years. I haven't found anything.
It's terrible work. It is the worst work you can do in the world. I feel bad for these young kids who come out of these fancy MBAs. They spend too much money for these degrees, and they get hired by a private equity firm, and their job is they have to buy companies. They have to make phone calls to jerks like me. I set my watch every Friday at 4 o'clock, because that's when my phone starts ringing, because it's private equity firms call, because they have to call. They have to drum up these opportunities. It is so hard to find these opportunities. And people make a mistake, I think, quite often, whether it's a private equity firm, whether it's an individual, and that is passive versus active. And a lot of times they're very passive. I have a term, I call it passive ask. So if you're trying to buy a company, don't do this. Don't call up somebody and say, here's my list of the perfect company, why it's perfect for me. And when you find that perfect company for me, call me and then I'll buy it. Okay, that's a passive ask. You are passively asking somebody else to do your job. So instead of calling up people like me, show me your companies, I'm not going to do that. I do my homework. I want to find buyers, whether it's another company, private equity firm, whatever, that we might think are going to be viable buyers. I will make the contact, or somebody on my team will make that contact. So if you want to buy companies, two things you need to do. One is be proactive. Put a short list together and reach out to companies that you might be interested in buying. So do a lot of homework. You've got the internet these days. You can do a lot of homework and determine that. Find a way to connect with the owner of those companies. That is going to be difficult. Do not call up and say, hi, I've got a lot of money and experience and I want to buy you, because business owners get that 20 times a day. They're sick of it. Come up with a thesis, a reason that somebody wants to talk to you. You see something in the industry, you want to get somebody's expertise, get the other person talking. And if you can, as much as possible, don't even ask. See if you can offer something. We were talking about this before the podcast that we're recording. I played golf a few years ago with somebody who was a former private equity guy, struck out in his own to buy a company. And we golfed for a few holes. And I had a feeling I knew where this conversation was going. And I asked him, how's it going? And his body language changed. And he said, it's a lot more difficult than I thought. This guy had a membership in a very exclusive golf course in the Chicago area. Very, very private, exclusive, very expensive golf course. And I asked him, how many business owners have you taken out as a guest? He laughed at me. Why would I do that? And I said, you have a golden ticket. You're going to tell me that if you can find a way to connect with business owners and you invite people out there to play golf at this very expensive, exclusive course, that some of them aren't going to take you up on that offer. And then if you're artful enough, you can start asking questions and see if you can move it along, the conversation along. What do you want to do with your business? So it starts with having a thesis, finding a way to offer something and being proactive instead of reactive. The second thing is, if you've got a company or private equity firm, is use... make sure Capital IQ, for example, has all your information. It shouldn't cost you anything. I have to pay money to use Capital IQ, but that is how guys like me put buyers lists together, put a website together, make it very easy for people like me to contact you. Don't put a fancy title down, put corporate development. I want to see people who have corporate development in their title when I'm selling something, because corporate development means I buy companies. So those are some tips. I've told this a million times. Very few people follow through. I don't know why.
I just wrote corporate development down. I like that.
No, I mean, it's all about adding value, right? Like, figure out ways to add value where you're going to broach the subject at a later point in time, right? You got to catch people whenever they're disarmed, not whenever they have all their shields up. And picking up a phone call, I mean, I get it all the time, right? I get pretty much anytime I get a New York number. I mean, I don't answer my phone at all, but 9 times out of 10, if it's a number out of New York, it's someone asking if we want to use them for debt. And, you know, I have 20,000 of those guys, right? Versus the guys that'll come out, do something completely orthogonal, then they can broach the debt subject. That's the way to add value and get that conversation. But Bill, a question for you. So you're talking about how someone can go directly to a seller. Maybe my question to you is, how would someone work with you, right? As a kind of intermediary, right? What's the right way to build that rapport? You know, like I said, you're choosing the buyers, right? And so how do we build rapport with you? How do we gain your trust and confidence?
It's done some calculations, and by some estimates, the number of buyers, strategic buyer, or not strategic, but just private equity buyer, financial buyers, somewhere around 7,000 in the United States, running the gamut from the big funded PE firms to a guy or a couple guys that just buy companies on their own dime because they find things that are cool. You've got 7,000. They call us all the time. For us to stay in touch with them, I hate to sound like this, but it's impossible. It's just absolutely impossible to stay top of mind. The best way to stay in touch with people like us is to make sure your information is up to date in Capital IQ. Okay, have your contact name, phone number, email address, make it easy. all the types of companies that you're looking for, get very granular, things like that, PitchBook maybe as well. I don't have any stake in any of those companies. Those are just some of the tools we use, and have a website. Make it easy. I'm going to go on and on and on. I go nuts when I see these companies. And what do you have in these companies on their websites? The president, CFO, the chairman, they always put their mugshots and their very impressive bio front and center, yet they don't want to be contacted. So very simple thing. If you don't want to be contacted, okay, but you have to put your picture up on your website, don't call yourself the president or the CEO. Call yourself the director of IT sales and SEO sales. Nobody will ever call you. Okay. If you want to be contacted, do not use business development. I don't want to talk to business development people. I want to talk to corporate development. Write that down. Put down VP of corporate development or something like that, and people will contact you. Make it easy for people to contact you. You can improve your LinkedIn. There's probably people who are better than me at tips on using LinkedIn. But, you know, I accept invitations from almost anybody. You just never know where you get something good. I'm always puzzled why people at private equity firms and corporate development people put up all these barriers to connect with investment bankers and other financial professionals. That just doesn't make any sense. You want to cast a wide net. So hopefully there's a few ideas there that
And here I thought you were going to say the easiest way to stay front and center is to bring you lunch, right? Which 9 times out of 10, most guys aren't going to do that. And that's the way you stand out above the crowd.
If I never have another business lunch again, I will die a happy man. Everybody wanted to drive you to every drive all over hell and back and come see me and I want to have lunch. And then they also cancel at the last minute. Everybody wants to have lunch. I could have 15 lunches a day. I actually want to have lunch. I don't want to have lunch. Don't bother me with lunch. Call me up and say that you've got a very expensive golf course you can take me on as a guest. Okay, I'll do that. Yeah, that's a good offer.
That's great. So that's what you mean when you say you like to give, not instead of asking for, right? You're giving, yeah. And you're looking for ways to get that buyer or you know really the seller to come and do something or engage with you without asking them anything about their business. It's more about let's start with that first.
Yep. Now there's a time to ask for the business or so forth. Of course. But if you're starting with, we've got a lot of money, we've got industry experience and a lot of money, we want to buy your company. Every business owner hears that every single day. It's a background noise. I call it eardrum buzzsaw. It's just that white noise that's buzzing in your ear. You walked into a buzzsaw. You want to avoid that. Look at what a great lesson for people if they can do this is to try to position themselves as a business owner and see the inanity that comes over the transom from private equity firms, from people that are selling fractional jets and databases and bespoke suits and investment bankers and stuff like that, and see the stupidity that comes over your transom, okay? And then ask yourself, am I doing the same stupidity? Because if you're doing the same thing that everyone else is doing and you expect a different result, you're going to be sorely, sorely disappointed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, good advice.
About doing, yeah. I always have to have something to differentiate you.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you. So, I mean, on the investment banking side, we've talked a lot about buyers. What about sellers? Like, how does a seller work with you, right? Do they approach you? Do you approach them? And ultimately, you know, what does that process look like for any sellers in the audience?
Sure. That's a great question. We, as investment bankers, have the same challenge that the business buyers have. We have to find the client, and it is really difficult to find the client. Going direct, you know, sometimes that can happen. Look, I met a client on the golf course once. Wasn't looking to meet a client. It's 4th of July. I was playing golf with a friend, and we make the turn. And, hey, there's two other guys playing with us for the last 2 hours. I start talking to one of the guys. He has a business. And I tell him what I do, and I wrote this book. He said, wow, I might want to sell my business. And I was kind of, I just want to play golf and drink a beer. Leave me alone. It's 4th of July. And seriously, and he kept pestering me. And so, you know, we developed a good rapport, and his firm hired me. We sold the company, which led to another sale. That's a happy accident. But you can't expect that. But that's getting out there, that it's being quick-witted and open-minded and looking to meet people. Play golf. I highly recommend you play golf. You'll never know who you meet out there. Typically, we get referred in, okay? And so the way that I stay in touch, I'm giving away all my super marketing secrets here. So I don't ask. I offer a lot of things. So what do I offer? I have a big email group, a lot of professionals that I stay in contact with. How do I do that? I don't send them any business stuff because business stuff is boring. A okay, I'm the biggest hypocrite in the world. I've written 4 business books. I hate business books. I don't read business books. I absolutely hate that kind of stuff. I find it very, very boring. I don't get anything from them. I get my insights and other ideas elsewhere, a lot of histories and biographies and stuff like that. But I keep in touch with lawyers, accountants, wealth managers, commercial bankers, and a few others. Okay. These are people who have the ear of a business owner. And what I want to do is find a way to stay top of mind. So when these people, and I don't know where they're going to come from, I don't know who's going to be the next one, but where somebody has a conversation, I'm thinking about selling the business, or the wife is tired of the winters here. We want to move to the house we have down in Florida. I don't know what to do with the business. You should sell your business. How do I do that? You need an investment banker. Oh, I don't need any investment help in a banker. Well, investment bankers are not investment professionals, and they do nothing. They do nothing with investments, and they're not a bank. They call themselves investment bankers. So I want to be on that short list. So how do I do that? I have emails, very creative emails. I can guarantee you nobody writes emails like I do. I host happy hours. I give away stuff. I just made a big purchase this year. I bought baseball tickets. I'm here in Chicago, so I have these fabulous ticket giveaways. In fact, I'm giving away tickets now. I have an algorithm that I wrote to decide who gets these, wins the tickets. All about 40 games that I'll be giving tickets away to. So this is something that I can do. It's a lot of fun. People ask me all the time. My algorithm has a name. It's called Gimme. They think Gimme's alive. They ask me all the time. Okay, so I'm top of mind because I've been creative and so forth. And so I have to make sure they know what I do. And so I hit them with multiple prongs, but I want to be the one top of mind. I want to be the memorable one. So when they have that opportunity, they at least think of me to get a chance to bid. So there's my marketing, everybody.
That's great.
No, I mean, and that's one thing I do want to hit on that. I mean, in my first software company, really, it failed because we did not understand the value of sales and marketing. So I knew we'd never make that mistake again. And it's so why we do this podcast, right? You figure out ways to add value to people or give them value that you might not otherwise, right? Like right now I got a, you know, 45-minute hour conversation with Bill. Bill's going to know who Equity Launchpad is and what we're doing after this because we have a platform, right? We're helping market Bill and vice versa. It's doing those kinds of things to stand out is how you grow. Right. Same thing with our conference that we have coming up May 11th. It's a platform to put people on that we may not have a way to add value to otherwise. Right. But they remember you. And I coincidentally said this phrase to Casey earlier today. It's not about who you know or what you know. It's about who knows you. Right. Yeah, and being that person, the first someone thinks, OK, I need to sell my business. Oh, there's Bill. I remember Bill. He took me to this game. He did this. He put me on this podcast. He did this interview, whatever it is. Right. That's what it's about. And that's why Nike pays to get their, you know, their logo put so many times. It's not because you're going to buy it off of one, but it's about that repetitive process and being top of mind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And before I get into the next thing, do you guys know the difference between sales and marketing? It's a question. And anybody can, especially
I have my interpretation of what the difference is. Yes. I probably don't know your answer to it.
Here it is. And this is my one great strength, or at least what I think it is, being able to take a complicated subject and explain it very simple. So sales and marketing. Marketing is what you do to get a chance to make a sale. Marketing is what you do to get a chance to make a sale. You ask most people with a marketing degree, they can't give you a succinct answer like that. But you're absolutely right. You know, when I look at this networking or whatever you want to call it, I have five things. I call it the 5 B's. It's kind of hokey, I know. 5 B's, which is be professional, be knowledgeable, be honest. Okay. Most people have that in business, right? You know, you're talking about a professional, you have good ethics, you're honest. That's great. You want to be active. This is the one where a lot of people fall down, myself included. You get busy with a lot of other things and you're not active. You don't stay top of mind. And as much as possible, be memorable. Okay. A long time ago, I devised what my strengths and weaknesses were. One of my weaknesses, I'm terrible with names and faces. I've had so many conversations in downtown Chicago with people who know me, and I have no idea who I'm talking to. So I own it. I don't know. I'm terrible at placing this kind of stuff. So I decided a long time ago, I'll be the one who's memorable. I'm kind of a normal-looking guy, but I thought I'll just be outspoken. And actually, the more outspoken I am and the less I care about what people think, it seems to be working for me. So I want to be the memorable one. I want people to remember me. I don't want to blend in. I don't want to be the best at fitting in. It sounds like a Dr. Seuss book. Okay. But a lot of people in business,
growing up, right? Name is Ferris. And you know, people used to make fun of you, Ferris Bueller, right? For those that know who Ferris Bueller is. And I learned as I got older, it's about being memorable. So now I introduce myself Ferris, like Ferris Bueller. And for usually the older guys get it, the younger people, those, you know, we have some young people here in the office, they don't even know who Ferris Bueller is. So then I go to Ferris Wheel. But in both cases, it's very memorable, right? People aren't going to forget that. Bill, you're going to think about it in a month from now, see Ferris Bueller, you're going to be like, oh, there's that guy Ferris on the podcast, right? Being memorable is important, whatever it is for you. Casey, keep your shirt on, all right?
Exactly. Nothing crazy.
I'm thinking non-ferrous metal is what I'm thinking of when I see your name.
And that works too. You know, I'll take the metal space all day.
So, Bill, we've talked about the hard stuff, right? We talked about search. Obviously, people can go, they can get your book. I'm sure you go a lot deeper into these conversations, and they should read as much as possible if you're sitting there wondering what your next steps are. So what about the fun stuff, right? Fun for you is the negotiations, and that's because you understand the financing and you understand the deal structure. So that makes it fun.
Sure.
Most people have no clue what an earnout is and how all of these different structures are, and really that there's really no limitations on your deal structure. I mean, I literally, the deal that we struck back in May with our acquisition, I mean, he literally said, hey, here's my objection. And I would just throw out, well, what if we did this? And he was like, I like that. So we papered it. I mean, it really became like, he told me what he liked. We said, well, we could do this. You could do this. And then we did it over like 20 different breakfast, lunches, dinners, just really hammering through the deal. So let's get into negotiations. I mean, you know this stuff very well. What you got?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Negotiation, that quite often scares a lot of people. Why? Because they think of it as bluffing, right? That's it is. You have to rip somebody off. You have to bluff. And what I always tell people is, you know what? Bluffing doesn't work, okay? If you bluff, be prepared to have the bluff call. And for me, there is an analogy with negotiating. It goes back to poker, playing poker. And if you want to do this kind of work for some reason, I have to ask, you know, what is wrong with you? Did you fall down a flight of stairs? But you need a certain skill set. Accounting, you need to be an expert in accounting. You need to be an expert in math. So if you didn't like high school algebra, you don't want to do this kind of work. You need to be an expert in writing. If writing that 10-page paper when you were in high school or college was a pain, you don't want to get this work. It's a lot of writing. And then beyond that, it's having the poker skills. And it's not bluffing. It's not the big, you know, like you might see in some sort of movie, you know, very theatrical type motion. For me, the lesson is reading your hand. In comparison to the other players at the table, do you have a strong hand? Do you have a weak hand? If you have a weak hand, you have to figure out, how do I get out of this as cheaply as possible? And if you have a strong hand, and I think this is something where a lot of people fall down, where they make mistakes, they overplay a strong hand. If you play cards and you have a strong hand and you bet the maximum, or you bet really strong right off the bat, what do? You chase all the other players out of the game, and now you've won the ante. You know, you get your ante back in a couple bucks more, right? Big deal. You've misplayed a strong hand. And the same thing applies in negotiating. So if you have a strong hand, that's great, but you can't be so over the top with your asks and so forth and demands that you just push everybody away. That to me has been the most beneficial thing. So if you want to get in this business and you didn't spend some time in college drinking beer or playing poker with your buddies, you don't want to do this kind of work. And golf. You need to know how to golf, because you'll find clients out there. So if you don't know how to do math, accounting, write, play poker or golf, this is the wrong business for you.
So Bill, kind of going into that, you know, also there, one of the things that, like when making an offer, right? So now I've negotiated, but even before we get into that positioning, my indication of interest, structure, all these pieces, do you find that there's an art in regards to that first offer? Meaning, you know, we've made offers that we felt like the people on the other side came back and were like, man, you lowballed me. I'm pissed, right? Do you feel like there's an art form there? Or how do you typically, what is your math formula when you're making your offers and knowing that there's going to be some type of trade back and forth, but that first offer, where's that magic?
Well, it depends on what your metric is, or what your financial metric is, or in my case, if I'm representing the company, what is their metric? You know, do they have a cost of capital that they're looking to hit? Are we going to run those sort of numbers? Or a lot of times, big companies that want to make acquisitions and never sell them, they just look at payback period. We're going to invest money. How long before we get the money back? Then everything after that is crazy. So you want to understand that. Ask the other sides. If you're trying to buy a company, ask the seller. What are you looking for?
No, it's funny. So we did a podcast interview with JB Sauceda, and, you know, in it, he actually had a good point, which is, you know, it's about being selfish, and not about selfish, like we're taking advantage of the person, but it's about, hey, here's the things that I really need that I care about in this deal. And the seller, or the buyer, you know, the other side will do the same thing. Yeah. It's about finding something where both sides are selfishly getting what they want and walk away happy. And I thought that was a really unique interpretation. I hadn't really thought of that one.
No, that's true. Look, you have to, whether you're buying or selling, you have to negotiate for yourself. You can't negotiate for the other side, nor can you expect, nor should you expect the other side to put together a fair deal for you. You have to expect them to put a deal together that makes sense for them. Your job is to negotiate, agitate for a deal that makes the most sense for you. Where it gets creative and a lot of fun is trying to bridge those differences and come up with a way of some sort of solution. When I do these things, you look at the numbers. I mean, it's always going to boil down to this horrible metric called EBITDA, invented by the cable TV entrepreneur named John Malone. EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, amortization, which is good and bad. You know, it's what we use, right? And it's usually multiple. You pick a number. You want to ask, if you're buying, ask the seller what they're doing. Now, when I'm selling, I wouldn't give a number. I provide the information, your financials, and so forth, and let the buyer come back with an offer that they can support the close. But ultimately, if someone makes a bid on your company, I think it's incumbent on the seller to come back and say, yeah, this is good, I can go move forward, or it's not good, let me come up with a counter. I mean, instead of just saying this isn't good, come up with a counter offer. And you want to be reasonable as well. We were trying to buy a company a number of years ago. We put together a very fair offer. We're going to buy the company over time and make some investments and buy shares over a period of time. And the seller came back. I still laugh at this. It's $1 million in earnings. And we put together something that would have made everybody involved very, very wealthy. The guy negotiating wanted $87 million at close for $1 million EBITDA business. That was for half the company. And then we could buy the remaining half over the next few years. And of course, that was a non-starter. And he never understood that. I mean, that is just, it's something like a cliche, it's a bridge too far. And it's just not going to work. You looked at my client as having a lot of money and just thought, well, they'll just spend bad money. Well, they've got a lot of money because they don't spend bad money. They're very careful about how they run their business. You have to understand that if you are selling, what are you asking for? Look, I mean, you should absolutely agitate for your best interest to get the best deal for you. But you have to ask, if the roles were reversed and somebody was offering to you or asking you to pay the same price you're asking somebody else, would you take that deal? And if you would not take that deal, then you know what? Probably someone else is not going to take that deal.
Yeah, it's not a charity.
Where were you, Bill? One of the other conversations we have with a lot of people is like, hey, so everybody's got their kind of rule book for multiples, right? So, hey, if it's this sub 2.5 million EBITDA, you know, these things trade below 4. If it gets above 2.5, you know, this next lower middle market, you know, I don't want to go above 4, 4.5, whatever those numbers are. Where are you and how are you and your, you know, the people like you in investment banking, how are you guys finding and building your multiples? Sure.
Yeah, I will give you the formula for valuation. You guys have a pad, please choose, write this down. This is an insider's look at valuation. Okay, it's a very complicated mathematical formula. I'm going to give you the shorthand for it, okay? Very complicated mathematical formula that largely depends upon what side I'm representing. It's a joke, guys.
I get it.
It's okay, maybe not. Yeah, you know what? Well, generally speaking, the greater the earnings, the bigger the multiple. Okay, and it's going to depend on the industry. What we used to say is we want at least $1 million in EBITDA. Those are getting difficult to place these days because the buyers just don't want to put the brain damage in trying to buy something that's relatively small. So it's at least 2 million that they'd want to see. And then you're going to look at other factors too. Is the company growing? What is the gross margin? What is the EBITDA margin? Is the management team staying? Do they have any concentrations with customers? Do they have any concentration with vendors? All these sort of factors, aspects get factored into valuation. So, in fact, I have a presentation I'm working on, and I'm calling it Not All EBITDA is Created Equal, because a lot of business owners struggle with that, or they have a short-term blip, and their numbers look really good, and they want to get the maximum valuation, extrapolate off of that, and that's not going to happen. We need to look at the trends, what's going on with the business, how much CapEx do you have? If it requires a lot of capital expenditures, that reduces the cash flow for a buyer. Is that going to have an impact on the business? So all those sort of things get factored in. And then valuation typically starts with science, right? You're crunching the numbers, you've got a spreadsheet, all this kind of stuff, and it always ends in art. You know, it's what you can get, and that's fine. So it starts with science, and it ends up with art. But if you want to get, if you're selling and you want to get the best price, What you want to do is have a growing business, no concentrations, have a management team that's there, that's not going to leave. You don't want to have any concentrations with your customers, with your vendors. You want to have strong margins. You don't want to have any headwinds in the business, whether that's regulatory or economic, all those sort of things. You want to put together the best company possible, and that is how you're going to get the best price possible.
You have to put a story together to tell, right? That's ultimately what it boils down to. Here's the story. Here's the why someone should buy it. And, you know, here's what they need to think about. And honestly, I thought you were going to actually give an answer where a lot of it is actually they need to come to you 2 years in advance so you can start to prepare, right? Because whenever you go to sell anything, whether it's real estate or a business, there is homework that you should be doing beforehand to set yourself up to have that story. So that way, whenever you go make the exit, right, you've shown that next buyer, hey, here's the potential, here's what can happen, and here's why the business is worth this extra multiple that you're looking for, right?
Yeah. You know, the problem there, see, you're very logical and objective, unemotional and reasonable with that comment. And that's not been my experience in the business world. People make it this. No, some do. You know, I have some friends, partners at accounting firms, and they will work with business owners, clients for a number of years to address a lot of these issues, these enhancers and detractors to valuation. And that's the way to do it. The tax planning as well. That is something that business owners just seem to refuse to want to do. Talk to your tax people ahead of time so you understand the structure. And the reason why you have to do a structure, is it really best to do a stock deal? Maybe an asset deal is better. If it's an asset deal, are you going to face double taxation? What is your accounts receivable going to be taxed at? Is accounts receivable going to be considered cash? Is that going to be considered income as opposed to long-term capital gain? There's a lot of little permutations that business owners just refuse to do the homework ahead of time. I really wish they would. We were talking recently with the business, and, you know, nice business, very profitable, but the concern is who's going to run the business after the business owner retires and moves on. And it's a nice business. As someone said on the call today, you know, it's a nice business to own. It's not necessarily a nice business to sell. And that's something as well. You want to think about that. It might be nice for you to own and you're making a lot of money. That's great. But if somebody buys the company, what are they buying? And if you, the business owner, handle all the sales and the product design and the finance and the accounting and everything else runs through you, when you're gone, what does the buyer have at that point? Who's going to run the business?
Really tough. One last kind of negotiation question that I think is a common is networking capital, right? This has been one of those things where we talk, it doesn't matter who we talk to, but like, how do you deal with networking capital? You know, so kind of give us your side from the buy side and the sell side, how either side, you know, how it all comes together.
Sure. So networking capital is typically, as you guys know, accounts receivable plus inventory minus accounts payable. You might have some prepaid expenses, you might have some accruals in there, but it's basically accounts receivable plus inventory minus accounts payable. But the reason that we have this working capital number in a sale is that we don't want a seller to have some sort of reverse incentive to do what? Sell off all the inventory, pennies on the dollar, collect the AR, pennies on the dollar, run up the accounts payable. In other words, trying to convert as much to cash, right? So if you do a deal and you're supposed to bring $5 million worth of working capital to the deal, that's to make sure that the business is sold and it's still working rather than the company's still in good working order, okay? What we do when we sell is I want to look at 36, maybe 48 months of their balance sheets. This is why you need to have this thing called young people who work for you, because it sounds like real work, who wants to do work. So you want to go through you got young people. That's what they're there for, right? They work for you for 1 week and they want to be the president. No, you're going to do the crappy work for a few years, for a few decades probably. So what you want to do is have these young people put the spreadsheet together, put the balance sheet together month after month, as many as possible, 3 years, maybe 4 years. And I want to see the trends, what's going on with working capital, and be able to communicate that to the buyer. And then the buyers can come back with a target. And then you have to negotiate. Is that fair? Is that reasonable? The working capital target, if we bring the company at the closing and we show the balance sheet, if that's under the target, that's going to cost my client, the seller, some money. If it's over, then the buyer has to pay a little bit more, okay? And you want to be fair, okay? It shouldn't be a big pickup for either side. You want to be reasonable. A big mistake that a lot of sellers make is they don't set that target correctly. They set it too high, and that might cost them a lot of money at close. So you want to be very careful.
Let me just stop you here, because I think you kind of ran through something that we learned on this last deal that I thought was really important. So you're saying when I'm issuing my letter of intent, right, we have a networking capital line item, right? But we're also saying, hey, it may take us 90 days to close. So there's a plus or minus, give or take, that's going to be in that, which is what we call a true up, right? So it's to true up at closing to then make sure that we have the networking capital necessary.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to have a balance sheet, an estimated balance sheet at closing, okay? And so you're going to negotiate at a time what the target's going to be, you're going to define working capital and what that target amount is going to be. And then at closing, the seller brings a balance sheet. Here's the working capital. Then you make some sort of adjustment. Okay, well, I'm the buyer. I need to put a little bit more, or we need to subtract a little bit because, well, they just got a big check for $1 million from accounts receivable. So their AR went down by $1 million, but they've got $1 million more cash. Doesn't cost you anything, seller. So you want to be able to communicate that. And then 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, whatever, some period of time after the close, when the dust settles, so to speak, you'll have the actual balance sheet, not the estimated balance sheet at the closing date, but the actual balance sheet, not estimated, but the actual balance sheet. And then you make some adjustments there if you need to make adjustments. And maybe some of the money that's been put into escrow is the buyer can say, wait a minute, you know, it's $100,000 we need to take. And so maybe the escrow is reduced by $100,000, or if the buyer has to put in more money, the buyer will put in more money at that short period.
Yeah. For those buyers out there that don't negotiate working capital, essentially money you're going to have to eject into the business day one just to keep it functional, right? That's why it's part of the, usually you need to negotiate that to be part of the business. And so if a seller thinks that I'm going to sell my business for $20 million, but they have $6 million of working capital, well, really that seller is going to take home $14 million, right? Assuming you bought it cash. So,
well, that's another mistake too, that they think, well, I'll sell for $20 million, and what are you going to give me for the working capital? And all the working capital is the assets that I'm buying. It's AR plus inventory minus AP. And thank it's you. Whatever, $6 million, that's part of the $20 million that I'm giving for the whole business. That's a struggle too for a lot of business owners. So those looking to buy a company, you're going to want to get your hands around that, because you'll see that a lot of times business owners have a tough time understanding selling the business and then the working capital.
We had that learning
lesson. We had the exact experience.
It was amazing. Luckily, we had a good seller, and we all got along, and we could really go down and do the math. So, Bill, we're coming up into time here, but we could literally talk to you for hours. I mean, you just gave me networking capital. For those listening,
take him out to lunch and talk for hours, right?
Oh, he's got baseball tickets.
I know.
We like the Cubs. Or are you White Sox?
I got the Tennessee White Sox. Is that what you? they're threatening to move to Nashville. But,
Are they really?
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Don't worry, we lost a team to Tennessee also, so way back when, Houston Oilers, so. Tennessee Titans.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, the White Sox do that every 30 or 40 years. They say they're going to move so they can get a new stadium, so I think they're doing that right now.
Ah, got it. So in that, we've got a little bit of a rocket round just to get to know you, but I wanted to say again, man, fantastic. This is just great information, and, you know, definitely when someone reads your book, they're going to get that type of knowledge, simplifying very complex things. So definitely, you know, that's the thing to go for.
And we'll have a link to the book in the show notes too, for those listening.
Thank All right. So for our rocket round here, what do you like to do in your free time?
As little as possible. I do a lot of writing in the summertime. I golf and try to do a lot more travel now as well.
All right. Fair answer. All right. Next question. What's been your most memorable moment in business, right? Was it a specific deal that closed, specific seller that left an imprint, buyer? I mean, what's it been?
I don't know if I have a most memorable moment, but for me, it's been the connection that when you have something to offer, talking about this earlier, as opposed to asking, that was the big reveal for me. When I thought about my career, the good stuff, the bad stuff, everything that happened, okay, I was upset about a business meeting that went bad over 20 years ago. So I wrote a little booklet called Venture Capital 101. I didn't know what to do with it. I just released it as a PDF and went all over the world. And years later, Wiley Publishing got a hold of that. They contacted me to write a book. It was a little bit of a gestation period there, but that turned into Mergers and Acquisitions for Dummies. What happens there? I get speaking opportunities. Now I go overseas. and deliver presentations. Why? I never asked for any of these things, right? I did something, I showed expertise and experience. I have a little bit of flair when I write, I think I'm a pretty good writer, and all these other things opened up. So stop asking, especially you young people, stop pestering old people like me for advice and free stuff. Figure out what you can offer. There's somebody else on the other side of the trade. And if you keep asking for advice, gimme, 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 you have to figure out what are you giving that person? And if you want doors to open, once you can figure out the world works on exchange, not take. And if you start asking as opposed to, if you start offering instead of asking, that's where doors start opening up for you. And that's where you can have a lot of fun in your life and your career.
Huge. All right. All right. And last one, easy. What's your favorite tool or resource? Like, what do you like to go to for business, personal? What is that tool you like to use?
In the M&A world, without a doubt, it's Capital IQ, which is an expensive database. They do a really good job of keeping tabs on all companies. You can get the public information, but also private companies if they're of enough size. And what's great is they tend to do a really good job of unwinding the corporate tree. So I can figure out who owns what. I can also do a lot of searching. So when we're selling, we will use that to build a buyer's list because we can get really granular in terms of what different companies, private equity firms and strategics, what they're looking for in terms of geography, in terms of the SIC codes and things like that. They get really granular. And that helps us put together a buyer's list. I would not be able to do this job without a database like Capital IQ, which is
awesome.
A lot of dollars in my pocket because it's enabled me to do my work.
Got it. Well, you don't need a buyer's list anymore. You just let us know what deals you got, Bill. I'll take a look. We're the only list you're going to need.
Yeah. Oh, hold on. Let me write that down. Okay. Got it.
Awesome. Well, hey, Bill. Pleasure. Thank you very much for being on the show. Really enjoy it. Yep. For the listener, someone who gets to get hold of you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can always get a hold of me at my website, billsnow.com, not billsnow.com, billsnow.com. You can track me down. That way you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter.
Perfect. Well, definitely a pleasure, Bill. Your guest, it's your host, Ferris Wheel, signing off. And so we'll call it a wrap. Thank you, Bill.
Bill, thank you. Thank you for listening to the M&A Launchpad podcast. If you've enjoyed today's podcast and would like to support us, please leave us a rating and a review after you listen. If you're looking for guidance on your next business acquisition or sale, capital to support your next business transaction, or to invest in a private equity opportunity, visit equitylaunchpad.com to learn more and to connect with our team. If you know of an individual who would be a great guest for the show, head over to equitylaunchpad.com/nominate, where you'll have the chance to refer yourself or someone else to be a guest on our show. I'm Casey Minshew, and I look forward to talking with you next week.